Lesson 34. I've been numbering them wrong recently. This is the 34th class in the Then and Now series. And tonight we're doing the perfection of wisdom. Your homework, I recall, was dropping into a clear state when you did something, right? How was this for you? So what was your experience? Kara, why don't you start?
Turn the microphone on.
Oh, this one? Oh, they're on standby, are they?
They're on standby. I find that this practice goes really well with the baking. There's definitely a difference in the product that I come up with when I'm baking with a very scattered mind with the focus on the end result than when I'm baking with a much clearer mind and just going from one moment and one task to the next.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's the difference in your experience? There we go. Go ahead.
It's significantly less stressful, or I just find it to be much more enriching, and then ultimately the product does end up being better.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else?
I noticed the most in like yoga, when you're doing a balancing position, if you start looking at what other people are doing or mind wandering, pretty soon you're starting to tip over one way or the other. So that was the main thing.
And when you...
When I'm focused, then I can stay there without tilting or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not talking about just being focused. I'm talking about dropping into that natural clarity, that resting mind.
Well, yeah, resting in the position.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Randy?
When I do something from that place, my mind shuts up. And there's a being with. I'm thinking of gardening particularly, which is something I really enjoy doing. I can do it and be thinking about all kinds of other things, or I can do it just kind of enjoying being with my flowers and tending them. And it's a much quieter place inside. Mm.
Okay. This is very good. Susan, do you want to say anything?
Okay. Well, when I first tried it, I did it when I was washing dishes, and only afterwards did I realize that in some ways I was doing it wrong, because I was using it as a way to meditate, and I was, it's like with shamatha, you rest with the experience of the breath. It's like I was resting with the experience of washing the dishes, and so it actually helped quite a bit. It was very calming and restful, and sort of brought me back into presence and attention, so it was good, but I was working at the perfume company all week and was given a number of extremely long-lasting repetitive tasks, so it seemed like the perfect opportunity to practice this. So this time I took a few minutes to actually meditate and drop open, and then did it, and it was an entirely different experience. It was kind of incredible, actually.
What was the difference?
I was just there. I was just doing it. Thoughts came and went. It was clear, open. They used the word uncontrived. It really fit. It was very simple. Yeah.
What was the difference in your body?
I was at ease.
Okay, thank you. So, all of you have mentioned this in connection with simple tasks, or relatively simple tasks, though I'm not quite sure how simple all the baking is, but it was things you were actually doing. And this is a very, very good place to start. It's something that you can do all the time. You may find it a bit more challenging, but it is very important to learn to do it also in interaction with people. Now, that's more difficult because more conditioned stuff gets pulled up there. There's very different kinds of habituation at work, but you'll find that if you do exactly the same, where you just drop into that open clarity and function from there, you're not going to be able to have the same conversation. There'll be different conversation. Yes?
I actually did try it with a friend.
And?
Who was deeply upset. He was just like full-on raging anger. Like, mm-hmm. Not at me. He was just angry. And it was pushing all my buttons until I decided to try that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
I was more present with, I was more fully there with what was going on with him without anything being in the way of it. And I saw that he was just expressing his pain.
I'd like to ask you, was that because you were more fully in your own experience?
I guess that's a way of putting it.
Yeah. Because you say I was more in touch with him where he was. But that's because we are completely in our experience, so we're feeling it much, much clearly and much more viscerally because we aren't reacting to what's arising in us.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's really, really important piece. So thank you, Susan. Okay. So you get the picture. Much more difficult because there's a much very different level of conditioning that comes up. But you practice this, and it doesn't have to be when somebody's really upset. It's very interesting to do this with casual conversation. Find it completely derails a whole bunch of social conditioning and everything. Leave you a bit of a loss sometimes, but that'll be good for you. Okay. Perfection of wisdom. It's going to be extremely challenging to do this in one class. We'll see what we can do. In looking this over, it's a very long chapter, and there are a lot of logical arguments in it. And buried in all of this are some very important principles. So I'm going to do what I can to bring out those important principles this evening. We'll just see how we do. Do you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. The perfection of wisdom is discussed under the same seven headings that Gampopa has used for all of the other perfections. In the discussion of the faults and virtues or the pros and cons of the perfection of wisdom, he goes into some length about the importance of means and wisdom. Now, this is a old traditional classification, the wisdom aspect being knowing things and the means or method aspect being how we interact with things. And the idea is that wisdom or knowing just by itself, this deep kind of insight, allows you to see into the nature of things. But doesn't in just by itself give you the skill of interacting with things. And on the other hand, developing the skill of interaction doesn't in and of itself lead you to freedom. That knowing that everything that arises has no inherent existence, which is the essential quality of wisdom, does. Now, on a somewhat different level, to give you the idea of this, some people understand very, very well how things work. They can see into the nature of things. Like you can think of a psychologist who really understands how people work inside. But that psychologist, if they're particularly a research psychologist, may be hopeless at actually interacting with people. And Randy's rolling her eyes. On the other hand, you can have... Pardon? Yeah. On the other hand, you can have people who are extraordinarily skilled in interacting with people, but who get totally caught up in the interaction all the time. And in the same way, you can have people who really see into how economic system or an irrigation system or the biology of a plant, just to use three different examples. But the person who really understands how the economy works may be hopeless at handling his or her own money. The person who understands how irrigation systems work may or may not be able to actually build one, let alone grow plants. And the person who understands the inner workings of the biology of plant cells may be a hopeless gardener, doesn't know how to actually interact with things. And you have the other side. You have sometimes very skilled gardeners who don't understand the science or the inner workings of it, and et cetera, et cetera. So there are these two aspects to knowledge. And so that, in a very rough sense, is what means and wisdom are referring to. And in the Mahayana, means is the domain of compassion. Wisdom is the domain of pristine awareness or wisdom or what have you. And these two are regarded as the two wings of a bird. And it is only when you have both wings in working order that the bird can actually fly. And that is how you become free, not only from the vicissitudes of samsara, because you see into the working of things, but also from the isolation and detachment, actually, that wisdom can produce. Okay? Yes?
Just a quick clarification. What Gunther is translating as beneficial expediency?
That's means.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out. That's why I'm working from Kensho Gyaltsen's, because Gunther gets a little carried away with some of these things. Yeah. Okay. Now, in what we call the perfection of wisdom, this word wisdom, is actually much more a form of intelligence than transcendent quality. And in Buddhism, we have a very interesting and also, I think, a very useful and simple definition of intelligence. Intelligence is the ability to make distinctions. Now, take carpets, for example. I know very little about carpets, especially Middle Eastern carpets. So I have no idea I have some idea, a few things I know about whether it's a good carpet or not. But someone who's grown up with that and is able to see very definite distinctions in the quality of the dyes, the quality of the weaving, the quality of the pattern, the quality, you know, is really going to be much more intelligent in that area than I am, because he's able or she's able to make distinctions or see differences that I can't. And it's the same in every area. So you have this definition of wisdom is the perfect and full discrimination of all phenomena. Now, again, I have a big problem with the use of the word phenomena. I like to replace it by experience. So what is being said here is that the perfection of wisdom is knowing precisely what you are actually experiencing. And you're not confused by the arising of experience at all, because you know precisely what it is. And knowing precisely means that you know it is its empty nature as well as its arising nature, because that's part of it. And that's a distinction that most people trapped in the ordinary experience of things can't make. They can't see or know the empty nature when the experience is arising. You see what I mean, Kara?
Can you just give an example of that?
I can give you it's more of an analogy, but I think it's in the right direction. You're at your baking school, you have interaction with these people, and somebody makes a big deal about something that you know isn't a big deal. Okay? Your knowing it isn't a big deal is analogous to knowing its empty nature. So it's still arising, but you know it isn't a big deal, so you can let it go easily. Do you follow? So when you know all experience is empty, you don't get bent out of shape by any of it. You stop reacting to completely, because you know that nothing is the end of the world. When we take what arises and experiences fact, then we get bent out of shape very quickly. So when the person, you know this isn't a big deal, but when they make it a big deal, they're taking it as a fact, and they get totally bent out of shape. And now it becomes a big mess because they react to it rather than just experience it. Does that help? Okay. Classification. Ordinary wisdom, which is just what we would regard as knowledge and training. You can see a study of linguistics and healing and reasoning. It's what we get through our education system and through experience in the world and so forth and so forth. The lesser supramundane. Wonderful English. It's a partial understanding of the nature of experience. And he spends most of the time in section C on the wisdom of the greater supramundane, which he defines as hearing, reflection, and meditation on the followers of the Mahayana. And quoting from the perfection of wisdom, the realization that all phenomena are unborn, that is the perfection of wisdom awareness. Again, huge problems with the translation here. Let's change the realization that all phenomena are unborn to something like to know directly that all experience arises from no thing. Now, many of you have done this whole thing with, you know, where is the seeing? You remember that? it's going to be a little difficult for people on the podcast to appreciate that. But when we look at something, we have the experience of looking at a flower or looking at a rose or seeing a rose, seeing a car or whatever. We very rarely stop to inquire, where does the seeing actually occur? And this is a very interesting question to ask, because we can't say that it occurs inside us. We can't say that it occurs outside us. And we end up not being able to say that that seeing is anywhere. That is what unborn refers to. You follow? Is that quality of this ineffability, the undefinability of experience. And this is why when we look at it this way, what arises in experience is just an experience. It's not a fact in the sense that it exists absolutely. And this is not to negate its power and its importance, the fact that it affects other things and so forth and so forth. But we find that reactions arise when we forget that things are experienced like thoughts and feelings and sensations, and we take what is constructed out of that experience, such as careers and jobs and relationships, etc., and regard those as facts rather than as very rich experiences. That's when our reactivity engages, and we suffer and we experience heartbreak and triumph and all of these things, which just completely mess us up. Okay. I don't like to use the word realization at all. It's usually something that's applied to realization of profit from a sale. I'm not quite sure how it's crept into Buddhist usage, but it has. And phenomena, I find, is a very misleading translation of the word chö or dharma, which is why I like to translate it as experience. Now, if we skip down to section 5, which is on page 236 in Kechok Jalton's translation, you see that you have these six heads. Refutation of things, grasping as things as being existent, refutation of grasping things as being non-existent, the fallacy of grasping non-existence, the fallacy of both grasping is the path to leads to liberation and nirvana, the nature of liberation. Well, the first four of these are all logical processes. They're exercises in reasoning of various forms. And they're designed to release our holding on to what arises in experience as being things. And so you'll see on 237... if this is explained according to the Lam Rim or the progressive stages, its existence and grasping of existence can all be categorized under two selves, and these two selves are by nature empty. The two selves are the self of persons and the self of phenomena. Well, you'll recall that much, much earlier in this class, I like to pose the question, what is the question that these two things are? These things are answers to. You remember that? And that's what I think will be very helpful here, because otherwise all of this just becomes rather dry logic. And in my own experience, very, very few people actually wake up through working through this on a philosophical basis, because one, it's way too conceptual, two, it doesn't really give you an indication of how to work with the emotional material that arises. And three, it is this kind of approach is actually only suitable for anger types.
What?
Anger types, because it's intellectual, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't do anything for desire types or stupidity types. You know, stupidity types do much better with devotion. So, what is the question, or the questions which the self of the individual and the self of phenomena, the self of experience, I would say, are answers to? Now, I don't expect you to get there quickly. That's somewhat rhetorical on my part. What I want you to throw out here is the consideration that these are answers to the questions, what am I and what is life? Well, when we say, what am I, we have this feeling that we are something. And this refutation of a sense of self is a way of saying, no, you are not a thing. You can go through all of these logical analyses as they do. But what we're really dealing with is this question of, what am I? And learning how, or what the important piece here is, how to enter into that mystery, which involves letting go of the notion that I am a fixed thing. I am something that actually exists. But I find it far more fruitful rather than try to apply this logic, which I've learned and I'm quite happy to do and have gone through many times, I just haven't found it that useful, is in meditation practice, is to say, when you sit, you say, okay, what am I? You know, am I my body? Well, no, that doesn't feel quite right. Am I my feelings? No, there seems to be something more there than that. And you just keep exploring. And as you keep exploring, you find that the sense of that I am something keeps running out through our, like sand running through our fingers. And by exposing, by just engaging this as an inquiry, not worrying terribly about the proof that I am not a thing, so much as just an inquiry into what is this experience of I, then begin to move from the notion that I is a thing that I am to the understanding that I is simply an experience. You follow? Whenever we're referring to that, we're actually referring to a very specific experience. And that's kind of strange, that I is an experience. And that shifts our relationship with it. Do you follow? Because we can have an experience of other, and then an experience of I, and then an experience of other, and then an experience of I. And that's basically what's going on all the time. And we just take those two things as things that exist absolutely, but that isn't how they are. So
say you get to a similar place when you look at things as being a dream?
Very much so, yeah. That's the other side of the coin. Here, they start working with the eye. If you go to 238, I think at the end of when we met 2 weeks ago, here you have the central arguments. Further, if the self or mind does exist, then investigate whether it rises from itself, from other, from both, or from the three times. It does not arise from itself because either the self already exists or it does not already exist. If it does not already exist, then it cannot become a cause to produce itself. If it does already exist, then it cannot produce its own result. Now, I suggested then that you replace the word cause by genesis, because it's very misleading with the word cause in there. So if it does not already exist, then it cannot be a genesis which for itself. In the same way, if you look at an oak tree, okay, you have an acorn and an oak tree. The oak tree produces acorns which produce other oak trees, but the oak tree doesn't produce itself. So a genesis can't produce itself. That's what it's saying here. Now, this is typical Buddhist logic. Some people love studying this stuff. As I've said, I don't find it particularly helpful as a way of really coming to know it. I think it is much better just to take it as a kind of inquiry into self, what am I, and really explore that experience. And there are different ways of doing that. We'll get to that in a minute. And then it runs through all kinds of arguments. The body... the next part, the self does not arise from the three times. Actually, it's time is a function of the sense of self. The more aware you are of, or the more that you're focused on the sense of self, the more conscious you are of time. How conscious are you of time when you have a headache? Time passes pretty slowly, doesn't it? How conscious of time are you when you're fully engaged in an activity? Time flies by, because there's no sense of a self there. You're fully engaged. So time is actually a product or not so much a product, but a manifestation of the sense of self, if you follow, or the subjective experience of time. Then it goes into is the self the body? Is it mind or within name? And these are all different ways of exploring the question of what am I? Then he goes into the self of phenomena, which is to say, which is what is life? Or a little more accurately, what is this experience we call life? Or even more accurately, what are all of these experiences to which we give the name life? Yes?
The self of phenomena?
In this sense, the self refers to something that exists in its own right. And so, what is the nature of experience that exists in its own right? Okay, because that's how we experience things now. Like I experience you existing in your own right and the chair existing in its own right, etc. But this is not how things actually are. And when you shift from the notion, from the category of phenomena to experience, it becomes much clearer. Experience only takes place when there's awareness, and you can't separate the two. When we talk about things, it sounds like there's something out there. But that's a projection onto our experience. You follow? So, all through this discussion, one of the things that I think makes it problematic is the use of this word phenomena. I don't want to go through all of these arguments. What I would encourage you, because I don't find it that helpful, because basically they're taking a certain Buddhist system that developed that many centuries ago, saying that experience arises from the combination of other units of experience, the so-called 75 dharmas. So the experience of seeing a blue circle arises when there's the dharma of blue, the dharma of round, the dharma of seeing, and the dharma of consciousness all come together. That gives rise to a blue circle, the experience of seeing a blue circle. And then you have this long argument of how do these things actually come together? Well, the argument falls apart because if these are irreducible elements, then they can't come and join, because if they join, then there's a left side and a right side, and now you've reduced it to something that's of a smaller unit. It's a reductio ad absurdum argument. And this kind of philosophy, I just find isn't helpful. What I think is far more helpful is, okay, just what I was saying a few moments ago, I see something. Okay, where is that seeing? I mean, I experience it very vividly, but where is it? It's a very interesting thing when you listen to music. And we have, very good sound systems, and it's like we're at an orchestra for a concert, and we can hear it, and we can hear it coming from different directions, okay? But none of that's there. Okay, where is the actual music? Where is the hearing of it? And this moves us into the mystery that it's an experience. It's not inside us, it's not outside us. And little by little, as we accustom ourselves to thinking and experiencing this way, we begin to realize that thoughts, feelings, and sensations, all of it, none of it's inside us, none of it's outside us. There's just, we're always in this field of experience, and that's what moves you into regarding everything as a dream, which is why that's such a powerful instruction. You follow? Okay. And that's what he moves into, simile on page 240. Similes, the appearances are like dreams, illusions, and so forth. Then the next point is that mind has not been seen by anybody, which is true. So that's all about the refutation of things existing as things. Now, you can take this, these four steps, refutation of things existing, refutation of things not existing, fallacy of grasping non-existence, fallacy of grasping, period, as a kind of progression. And the first thing we do is like, well, there's this world I experience. Okay. But if you start opening to that, the experience of the world, you begin to find it's not as solid or as straightforward as it seems, in just the way that we've been talking about it. So it's very natural then to move to the notion that, well, nothing exists. This is all an illusion. None of this stuff is really there. Well, that's not true either. Because, drop a brick on your toe, and that's a very vivid experience. So to say that things don't exist is also not true. Okay, so now one's confused. One has all of the stuff arising. And can't say that it exists, can't say that it doesn't exist. how do you live in that paradox? And what you begin to see then is that the problem is actually this whole notion of trying to define things. So, as I say, if you can't hold that everything exists the way it appears, can't hold the idea that things don't there isn't anything there. That isn't true either. And thank you. That works better than cold water. So, and this is what both section B and C are really about, is nothing exists. And it's my favorite quote from Asaraha. People who believe that things exist are stupid like cattle. People who believe that things don't exist are even stupider. You begin to see that the problem is this tendency we have to try to see things as this or that rather than just experience them, which is what Part D is about, which is explanation of the fourth, the fallacy of both graspings. Both grasping. And so now you really begin to enter the mystery, like, okay, what I need to do is to learn how to approach the world, approach experience as just experience. And that's what Part E is about, the path that leads to liberation. And it's, no, and you get, say, two or three quotes down. For that reason, the one wise one does not abide in either existence or non-existence. This is, of course, the middle way. And then Part F is